reconvene. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good afternoon. I'll call our third case of the day, 03-1959, Patricia A. Steiner v. Wisconsin Mutual Insurance Company, arguing on behalf of Robert Steiner and Mount Morris Mutual is Stacy K. Is it Luell? Counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the Court, my name is Stacy Luell, and I represent Mount Morris Mutual Insurance Company as well as Robert Steiner, the petitioners in this matter. The reason my client petitioned this Court to review the Court of Appeals' decision is because, respectfully, I submit that the Court of Appeals made an impermissible finding or inference that was not based in the record that has repercussions that has outcome that goes beyond this case to other cases that are out there. The Court of Appeals essentially found, based on an inconsistent date in a strict foreclosure judgment, that the parties who had originally sought one type of relief earlier and were granted that type of relief got together, changed their minds, and sought the relief of strict foreclosure judgment.
I'm going to ask you right at the outset, didn't the plaintiffs want strict foreclosure? That's what they asked for. And if I understand it, then the judge and the plaintiff and defendant talked about a possible sale. But they started out, just so I understand, with strict foreclosure.
That's correct, Your Honor. Essentially, the pleadings, they request a strict foreclosure judgment. They got to the September 7th hearing, which was before the accident that occurred. There's an issue of who owned the property at the time of a personal injury accident. At this particular hearing, originally the parties requested that form of relief. However, there were some outstanding tax liens and other liens, so the parties agreed, both on the record and outside of the record, and came back in and said, okay, we're going to go with this other remedy, which is specific performance, which essentially is a foreclosure and sale, a judicial sale of the property, rather than a strict foreclosure judgment, which is a calling off, a nullifying of the contract, the land contract, basically asking for the equitable title that was given to the vendee to go back to the vendor. The judge never, during that hearing on September 7th, granted strict foreclosure judgment. It was not until October 19th, when the judge signed and it was entered, that there was strict foreclosure judgment granted. Then, subsequently, on December 1st, there was a final order that clarified that no redemption was made within redemption period. And that was the final judgment. After sitting in on some of the oral arguments today, I went back and I read the synopsis of what this case is about. And one thing that was glaring to me was that, and I hope I can get this across because this is the crux of my case, is that strict foreclosure judgment was never granted until October 19, 1999. And the reason that's important is because by the court finding that the parties can come together and have an expiration or have a redemption period that expires before a judgment is even granted, they are essentially nullifying the statute. The statute 846.30, which requires that there be a 7-day redemption period from the granting of strict foreclosure judgment. Now, Wisconsin American argues that you can have the 7-day redemption period from the hearing date itself. However, you need something more than that. According to the specific language in the statute, you need to have a finding, a court granting the relief of strict foreclosure judgment in order for you to have the 7-day redemption period.
Counsel, can I ask, in that vein, as I understand it, no one objected to the fact that there was a hearing on September 7th. Now, under the statute, which you're referring to, 846.30, as I understand it, the court shall set a redemption period of at least 7 working days from the date of the judgment hearing. What was the hearing on the 7th of September?
The hearing originally was for strict foreclosure judgment, a default judgment hearing on the pleadings. However, the parties came in front of the court, something that did not occur if you accept the assumption of the Court of Appeals, went in there and said, we want a different type of remedy here. Would you please grant this? And the judge actually might have been part of that
decision. I think the judge suggested it, didn't he, rather than the parties.
That's correct. The judge was concerned about these outstanding liens, in particular the State of Wisconsin tax lien that was out there. So basically, there wasn't ever a finding there. And just because there's a hearing on something, you have to have the parties request it. The parties have to have notification of what they're requesting. They have certain due process rights in going there. And with the Court of Appeals finding that somehow between the September 7th date and the October 19th date, the parties did all these things. They're not only assuming. Yes, Your Honor.
I just want to ask you this. Isn't it significant that on September 7th, the court did set a redemption period of 30 days? Isn't it also significant in terms of the conclusions reached by the Court of Appeals that the Court of Appeals looked at the fact it was the same judge who presided over the foreclosure, the strict foreclosure proceedings, or the land contract foreclosure proceedings, if you prefer, and the summary judgment in regard to the personal injury case? Doesn't that tell us something? Doesn't that tell the Court of Appeals something in terms of whether or not they can draw reasonable inferences?
Well, to begin with, the redemption period that was granted on October 7th related to a judicial sale. September 7th, related to a different type of remedy, and that was of a sheriff's sale.
But then the Court of Appeals, excuse me for interrupting, but then the Court of Appeals said, obviously, when you look at the whole record here, what happened in the meantime was apparently everybody agreed, even though they didn't go on the record and do it, everybody agreed to go with strict foreclosure instead of specific performance. That you can't come to that conclusion if you look at the whole record. And then you couple that with the same judge involved in both cases, and that strengthens that position, doesn't that? I mean, isn't that a logical conclusion for the Court of Appeals to reach?
I don't believe so. I don't think you can make such a leap from the inclusion of a date that expired before the judgment was granted. And, yes, it does. The fact that the same judge was before the strict foreclosure proceeding or the foreclosure proceedings as well as 2 years later in the civil case may add some credence to the court's assumption. However, it doesn't take away from the fact that it's an assumption based purely on an inconsistent date in any judgment.
Well, do you think they're doing that the Court of Appeals was doing fact-finding? Is that your argument?
I do. I think that they put it under the guise of a reasonable inference from that particular date. And I think that there's a danger there, because if they're able to interpret inferences so broadly that it allows them to make a factual finding, it cuts away from judicial legitimacy. The decisions need to be fact-based. They need to be rooted into the record. And I don't believe that that is sufficient. The inclusion of the state is sufficient to take those leaps, to assume that the due process rights of everyone involved were adhered. I mean, just because you have a strict foreclosure judgment that includes an earlier date, there's no proof of any type of stipulation in order between the parties to show that each party agreed to it. There's only a strict foreclosure judgment that was signed on October 19th.
Yet no party involved was objecting to that. Isn't that correct?
And my position to that would be that there is no record to support that the other side, that the Vendees even knew about it. There's nothing to indicate that, because there wasn't a something provided due to the five-day rule, there wasn't any type of record or notation saying that each party agreed to. It's an assumption by the court that both parties agreed.
Counsel, help me with this, if you will. There is a difference, I think, between a reasonable inference. Is it a reasonable inference drawn by the Court of Appeals that the appropriate period of redemption commences or ends on October 7th? Is that a reasonable inference? What? Now, let me finish.
Okay.
Is that the inquiry, or is the inquiry Is the Court of Appeals correct in determining that the only reasonable inference is that the period of redemption expired on October 7th? There's a difference, I think, between is this a reasonable and is this the only. The Court of Appeals' decision was that this is the only reasonable inference. What legal import is that writing of the Court of Appeals, that this is the only reasonable inference?
Judge, I struggled with that quite a bit when I was preparing, because it doesn't quite fit in the summary judgment methodology, because I don't think that there is a disputed fact here. I think that the court said, okay, the Court of Appeals said, we're making a reasonable inference based on this date. And it's not the standard.
But I don't think, correct, now tell me I might be wrong. I don't think that the Court of Appeals said we are making a reasonable inference. I think the Court of Appeals said this is the only reasonable inference. If I'm wrong, correct me. But if I'm right, then that's what we should be focusing on.
Yes, Judge, you're correct. They said it was the only reasonable inference. And in my briefing, I do talk about that there are other reasonable inferences out there, others that I think are more reasonable. The fact that the October 7th date used in the strict foreclosure judgment was used in conjunction with future tense leads one to believe that there was certain documents that were put together for the September 7th hearing. They changed their minds, and then they were submitted later on without changing certain parts of the document. And what else supports that is the December 1st final judgment, which includes a 30-day redemption period beyond October 19th, 1999 date. And in addition to all that, the strict foreclosure judgment has a typed-in September for the date. That's crossed out by the judge when he signs the judgment and puts in October. That leads me to believe that this was a mistake within the contents of the judgment.
Well, didn't the court, and just Justice Bradley's question is, well, the other reasonable inference which you were asked to give us, but when I look at this, we're talking about October 19th, and that's when Judge Polivka said from the bench that the 30 days commencing as of September 7th is a reasonable time for the defendants to perform the said contract. And the defendants shall perform said contract on or before October 7th, 1999. Now that's what's in the record. And I think Justice Crooks raised the issue of no one objected to that. No, there hasn't been any objection until, of course, this other lawsuit was filed, which then the dates become very crucial. But as far as the foreclosure itself, both parties represented by counsel, and that was the judgment that was entered by Judge Polivka. And that's, for me, that's the issue of whether or not the Court of Appeals looked at the only reasonable inference from what Judge Polivka did.
The October 7th, or the September 7th hearing, there's the October 7th date that was given for the remedy of specific performance for the judicial sale. It did not relate to a strict foreclosure judgment. If that were the only reasonable inference from that particular fact, it's legally wrong. It's legally wrong because Section 846.30 says that you have to have a 7-day redemption period when strict foreclosure judgment is granted.
And I guess the question that has been asked has been that Judge Polivka was using the September as the hearing called for in the statute, and that no one objected to the strict foreclosure, which was originally what the plaintiffs came into court and asked for, a strict foreclosure. In other words, they talked about a judicial sale, but it never came to fruition. And the papers that were filed, and you correct me if I'm wrong, were for a strict foreclosure. And that's how the trial judge characterized it. And from that is where the inference was drawn by the Court of Appeals.
On October and September 7th, the court gave a redemption period to end on October 7th. And merely because there was a hearing held and the pleadings said strict foreclosure on them, that's not enough according to Statute 846.30. The statute says that there needs to be a finding that amounts to strict foreclosure judgment. By granting foreclosure, which is equivalent to foreclosure in a sale, which is equivalent to a foreclosure on a mortgage, it's not the same. It doesn't equate in the law to a strict foreclosure judgment. There are two different remedies, and the strict foreclosure judgment is kind of a different animal. It's based in equity. It's based in the inherent powers of the court in equity.
Yes, in your opinion, when did the Steiner Corporation lose any interest? What you're saying, they lost an interest. Well, it could have been the 26th of October, it could have been the 18th of November, or it could have been December 1st. But in any event, it wasn't before that date. In that context, just explain to me the position under the statute. You mentioned 846.30. Is it wrong to say that when the period of redemption ends, title passes, that's under the common law?
My position is that it's wrong. I think the statute is clear that...
So the statute changed the common law?
No, I don't believe that the common law was ever clear. I think that St. Joseph's Hospital addressed this, is the only case that really completely addressed this in great detail. There's also the Monona Golf case, which is before the St. Joseph's Hospital case. Exchange Corporation never nullified the view that there needs to be something done after the redemption period to declare title in the plaintiff and to revoke or terminate any rights of a vendee of the defendant. And that's a subsequent order entered to say that there was no payment upon redemption. Exchange Corp never changed that. Exchange Corp's focus was on the judgment itself. The specific issue in Exchange Corp was whether the court in equity had the power in equity after the redemption period expired to grant additional time for redemption period. In addressing that issue, the Exchange Court looked at the judgment itself. It did discuss some of the different views of how this strict foreclosure judgment, when it becomes final, or whether it was a decree in Nietzsche, I think. But it never came down to defining when it occurred. It simply said, we're going to look on a case-by-case basis at the judgment to see whether or not the court reserved this power within the judgment itself. Now, I read Exchange Court to mean that it did not change anything about St. Joseph's Hospital, about St. Joseph's Hospital's ruling. And then I think that in enacting the statute, the legislature looked to St. Joseph's Hospital. The legislative history shows that they did look to this and to this interpretation. And they used the wording that was used in both Exchange Court and St. Joseph's Hospital to mean when the rights are exchanged. And that's when it's final and when the judgment is absolute. And the statute says that does not occur until an order is entered confirming that there had been no payment during the terminate redemption period.
Well, that was stated, but what I'm wondering, isn't there an in limbo period? What concerns me, if you have, in other words, if the period of redemption, and that's what you're talking about, the Exchange Corp says basically that a strict foreclosure judgment may be considered an interlocutory judgment that automatically becomes final upon the expiration of the redemption period. What I'm trying to drive at is whether or not you have this period, the redemption period is run, and the judge doesn't enter a judgment. A judgment is not entered. Who owns the property? Who owns the property? Does the vendee still continue to own the property then? That's your...
My position is, first of all, you have to have a strict foreclosure judgment in order to have the 7-day redemption period. Once the 7-day redemption period is done, it is up to the vendor to submit the subsequent order to say that there was non-payment. It's the same thing as if is if there was a foreclosure judgment in sale. Up until the sale, where the interests and the rights are determined by the sale itself, the owner, the former owner, holds on to the property, and likewise, the vendee would hold on to the equitable interest until the judgment is made final, until there is court approval making the determination final.
Counsel, if I could, you've talked many times in terms of when the judgment is made final, when it is made final. When was there a judgment in this case? Non-final or otherwise?
There was a judgment of strict foreclosure on October 19, 1999. The judgment was not made final, according to the statute, until December 1st, when an order confirming that there was non-redemption was entered. That's when it became final. That judgment, the strict foreclosure judgment on October 19th, is an interlocutory judgment that does not transfer the title or the interests of the parties. What determines that, according to the statute, is the subsequent order that confirms that nothing was done within the redemption period.
What is a judgment hearing?
The judgment hearing, there's not a whole lot that I have found in the case law that talks about what is needed for this judgment hearing. However, the statute talks about that. And I'll quote it. If a court finds that a purchaser under a land contract is obligated to make certain payments under the land contract, that the purchaser has failed to make the required payments, and that the vendor is entitled to judgment of strict foreclosure, the court shall set a redemption period of at least 7 working days from the date of the judgment hearing, or if there is no hearing, from the date of entry of judgment order. I read those words to mean that there, at the very least, has to be a finding that there is strict foreclosure judgment. It's not sufficient to go in and request one thing, change your mind, and go after a different remedy, and say that now come back and say, oh, well, that was a hearing. That's sufficient to meet the procedural and statutory rights that are espoused in the statute.
Now, I have a question about the December 1 final judgment. Didn't it state that the October 19th judgment granted the defendants 30 days from October 19th to pay the amount due?
That's correct.
And you are assuming that that was ostensibly setting November 19th as the redemption date. That would have been the 30 days.
Yes, that's correct, Judge.
And then December 1 is the time they get that order drafted and signed and entered.
That's correct.
Does it really matter what the date is so long as it's after October 15th?
Excuse me, I didn't catch that.
Does it really matter whether the transfer date is October 19th or something in December or November, so long as it comes after October 19th?
Well,
October 15th, excuse me.
In this particular case, yeah, if it was after October 15th, then that's a whole dispute who owned the property at the time. But some of the issues that we're talking about here, when does the judgment become final? It does. It has significant importance because it tells parties when their interest, what their interest is, and when it's terminated and when it is transferred. It also tells third parties, people like in this case, people who have liens and have interest in the property in addition to the vendor and vendee, when the transfer occurs. But in this case, you're right, it doesn't matter. If you look at October 19th as a strict foreclosure judgment date, any time after that the redemption period was up does not matter because the strict foreclosure judgment was not granted until 4 days after the accident. And therefore, Wisconsin Americans Insured, the Steiner Corporation, still held onto the equitable title and, according to the case law, would be responsible for personal injuries that happened on the property.
Counselor, in your view of the statute and what's happened here, just say that Ms. Steiner didn't fall down until make it November 20th, so you're outside of what was said at the redemption period. Okay, so you don't have a final judgment. confirming strict foreclosure, who owns the property on the date she files November the 20th under your theory?
Steiner Corporation does. Because the judgment is not made absolute according to the statute until there is an order submitted saying that title has been transferred, that the judgment has been made absolute and final.
So even though the under common law, the equitable title reverts to the vendor at the conclusion of the redemptive period, and the vendor always had legal title, I guess I'm not sure what there is left to transfer by that last judgment.
I don't believe that the common law holds that the interest automatically transferred. I believe that this is an area that there were many different interpretations as to when the strict foreclosure judgment became final.
But, I think there are two different things going on here, which is why we're having, I think, a little trouble with this case. I think the common law does say that at the end of the redemptive period, the equitable title goes back. But property ownership in Wisconsin is a record concept. And I submit to you that perhaps what the statute did is confirm the record on the date that last judgment is entered under the statute rather than doing anything at all with the title. So that someone is with the title company and they're searching the record to see is it an insurable interest, they can say, oh, hey, the redemptive period has run, but we don't have a confirmation of that, so we have to have a confirmation so the record title is complete. What do you think about that?
I understand that point of view. However, I think if you look back at St. Joseph's Hospital at that case,
yep.
The wording is declare title. It is declaring and it's nullifying, and it talks about barring the interest of the defendant.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
Thank you. I'm out of time.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ms. Janicek, representing Wisconsin American Mutual Insurance Company.
If it pleases the court, good afternoon. My name is Tim Janicek of Bell, Gearhart & Moore of Madison. I represent the defendant respondent, Wisconsin American Mutual Insurance Company, euphoniously known as WAMIC, in the Court of Appeals and in the briefs we filed. Our rich history of common law, of course, began long before the state legislature enacted statutes. From time to time, the legislature will enact a statute that merely codifies the existing common law. At other times, the legislature will enact legislation that supplements common law in that it expands upon or clarifies an area where the common law was not established. And in those cases, the common law continues to be in full force and effect. In some statutes, the legislature intends to change the common law or to supplant it. In those situations where the legislature intends to change the common law, the intent must be clearly expressed, according to our case law. This is the rule of statutory construction which this court has followed for well over 100 years. By the year 1865, this court was already calling this rule of statutory construction a safe and established principle in the construction of statutes. Other prior decisions of this court say that a statute must be clear, unambiguous, and peremptory in order to change the common law.
Counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
I don't want to go back 100 years, but I'd like to go back to 1937, which was the case referred to by your opposing counsel, St. Joseph's Hospital, just to ask you, your read, when I look at that case, and the court observed that a judgment of strict foreclosure itself does not produce absolute finality until a final order is entered making the judgment absolute. And that, there is some legislative history that the legislature was looking at St. Joseph's when they drafted 846.30. Do you take issue with that as far as that's what they were trying to do, is to make some, to have some uniformity? Because I think it's always my understanding that the common law was when the period of redemption ran, that's when equitable title passed from the vendee to the vendor.
I think the St. Joseph's Hospital case, Your Honor, was put in perspective for us by the, in the times in which it was decided, by the Exchange Corporation case.
Coons case, right.
Yeah. The St. Joseph's Hospital case, Your Honor will recall, was a case in which a maternity association was conducting business, delivering babies and caring for mothers in need at St. Joseph's Hospital during the Great Depression, and was unable to meet the costs of paying a land contract. The Supreme Court allowed extension upon extension of the redemption period on a couple of what I would call policy theories, one being that no harm was being done because the maternity ward couldn't have been sold to anybody at any better price for the benefit of the hospital, and also they were, the hospital was doing good during this time of dire financial need for all people. When the Exchange Corporation case was decided, Oliver Wendell Holmes was quoted precisely on this point, that hard cases make bad law. And I think at that time the Supreme Court was recognizing that it may have, that St. Joseph's Hospital may have been the right decision at that time under the circumstances, but it does not reflect the law with respect to how strict foreclosures are to be handled.
Counsel,
yes.
How do you deal with the legislative history? Specifically, I have before me the September 29, 1995 letter from Chicago Title Insurance Company to Peter Christensen, who was the apparently the point person from the state bar putting together this legislation. And I hear you saying, well, St. Joseph's is an old case and consider it in the context and maybe it was bad law. But as I look at this letter to me very clearly says this. Now, correct me if you think it isn't so clear. This is what I think this letter clearly says. The letter clearly says, hey, Mr. Christensen, the proposed legislation is okay as far as it goes, and I'm quoting. However, the bill overlooks the requirement for a final order established under St. Joseph's Hospital versus Maternity Site. Then it quotes from St. Joseph, a judgment of strict foreclosure of a land contract, just like Justice Wilcox just quoted that excerpt that's saying that it's not final until you have the final order. Then the letter from Ron Antwin of Chicago Title Trust Company says, therefore, quote, we should take this opportunity to propose that AB 579 be amended to include a requirement for a final order. This can be done very simply by adding the following language as part of the proposed section 84630. So it reads now as follows. They set out the exact language, and lo and behold, that is verbatim the language, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, that was adopted by the legislature. So, boy, even if St. Joseph's was a lousy opinion, if our purpose is to interpret the statute, it sure looks clear to me that what they were doing is putting in the St. Joseph language, and they took the exact Crawford language. Help me with that if you disagree.
First of all, I don't think St. Joseph's Hospital was a lousy decision. It was a beautiful decision,
okay,
given the circumstances.
Strike that, then. I think my question can survive without that adjective.
Fair enough. Okay. An order, a final order, in a case of strict foreclosure is a great idea for a number of reasons. It may or may not fulfill the exact idea that the title insurance company had in mind there, but the final order does help title insurance companies and all of us because it establishes on the record that the strict foreclosure has been completed. If I'm correct, and the common law has stated all along that the vendee's loss of his interest in the property is self-executing. It happens by operation of law when the vendee fails to make a payment before the period of redemption expires, there is still some time in the litigation when other things are going on. For example, someone has to come into court and assure the court that there has been no redemption during that period of time. There are other cases that say that the court retains jurisdiction for a while, even after redemption, because the litigation is continuing. And there needs to be, perhaps the parties need help with, whatever the right word is, getting the people out of the property, ejection or whatever the proper term is. There attorney's fees, people coming up who may have an interest, a claim an interest, but there are things going on after the equitable title reverts to the vendor. When is the litigation completed? I think, Your Honor, that's the purpose of writing the final order. The final order required by the statute and suggested in the legislative history occurs to assure the public and the parties that this litigation is now complete. Doesn't say anything at all about when the title transferred, but that the litigation is complete.
Counsel, what about the discussions that took place in the September 7th hearing? As I understand it, there was discussions about a sheriff's sale that would take place. Given that discussion, isn't that somewhat different than that which happened in this case where you have now this judgment of strict foreclosure? It looks like they were talking about two separate things. You understand?
I do understand, Your Honor. Yes, and that's been a confusing point of this case all the way up the line. Everyone except Judge Polifka was wondering about it, and I do too to some degree. But I look back at what the record shows. The plaintiff in this case, Patricia Steiner and her husband, who were the vendors, sued for strict foreclosure. That's what their complaint asked for. When the defendants, the vendees, were in default, the vendors came into court and asked for default judgment on that basis. At the September 7 hearing, a representative of the vendees was there, David Steiner, one of the boys who was running the place into the ground, and that's in the record, I don't mean to be pejorative, was there and assured the court there was no way they were going to be able to redeem this. And there was a discussion as to whether, in light of the tax lien, it might be a cleaner, more appropriate proceeding to proceed to a sheriff's sale.
And the reason I bring the question up is I know that there's a body of law, and I'll cite from a case, State versus Perry. The reason I'm citing is I want to know whether or not you're aware of whether or not there's a similar body of law in the civil area. State versus Perry, a substantial number of federal courts of appeals and state courts also subscribe to the principle urged by Perry and followed in Wisconsin that where a conflict exists between a court's oral pronouncement of sentence and a written judgment, the oral pronouncement controls. Here you've got a transcript that kind of discusses what takes place on September 7th. And unless I'm misreading the record here, the Court of Appeals is making some assumptions about what took place between the September 7th date and the final judgment that was entered on December 1st.
I'm unaware of a body of law in the civil area that would be parallel to that, Your Honor. I think, though, for the Court of Appeals decision to be an assumption is probably a fair characterization. They also call it a conclusion, an inescapable conclusion, or the only reasonable inference. But we know that something happened during that time by which the discussion of submitting this to a sheriff's sale dropped out of the picture, and the parties who had an interest in this foreclosure action all agreed, or at least...
But how do we know that? That's where I'm stuck. You say we know that. How?
We know it because the judgment was entered by the court. A final judgment was eventually entered, and nobody objected or appealed from it.
Counsel, no one objected to the final judgment, but and that phrase, no one objected, was raised with regard to the October 19th judgment because it referred to the October 7th redemption period, and no one objected to that. But I take it, correct me if I'm wrong, no one objected to the final judgment of December 1st, and that very clearly says the court having entered its judgment in the above matter on October 19th, providing for strict foreclosure of land contract,
and that the parties shall have 30 days from October 19, 1999 to pay the clerk of this court the amount due under the Lyon contract, then based on the attached, and it goes on to say, based on the attached affidavit in support of the final judgment, it sets forth the period of redemption from October 19th, the 30 days beyond that. I therefore, the original judgment entered by this court on October 19th is confirmed in all respects. So, I mean, no one objected to that either. And that very, that very clearly sets forth a period of redemption 30 days from October 19th. That's the words that it uses.
Those are the very words it uses, Your Honor, and I cannot explain it any better than the Court of Appeals did when it said that has to be a mistake. The judgment could, that order could not both approve of what happened and had taken place before October 19th and change it at the same time. It had to be an oversight.
Counselor, is there a difference between a judgment that transfers title and a judgment that quiets title?
I think that's true, Your Honor. Yes.
And do those concepts have any relationship to any of the judgments, in your view, that are in this case?
I think in this case, the ownership transferred by operation of law on October 17, and if there had been a dispute about that by a third party who wanted to buy the property and had a question about ownership of the property during October or November of that year, they would have to file an action for quiet title. They'd be two
also,
kinds of proceedings.
Did you make a misstatement? You said October 17th. Did you mean the 7th?
I did mean to say 7th, Your Honor. Of all the dates in this case, I don't want to add another one that has...
that's why I interrupted you.
Okay. Thank you.
And when you say that ownership transferred by operation of law, you're not suggesting that that was in some way a judgment, are you?
No, Your Honor. I think the judgment and the order confirming that transfer come at a later date, as required by the statute. The actual transfer of ownership occurs when the person who is given a second chance to redeem his interest in the property fails to do so.
The judgment, I was trying to think to get some uniformity, the equitable title would have to transfer before the judgment because you can't have the judgment before, in other words, you can't have one before the other. So the equitable title has to transfer, whatever the redemptive period is, 30 days, 60 days, what is set by the court, then you're saying under 846.30, then there ultimately has to be a judgment which puts the finality. And leading into the exchange corporation, the court said there that a strict foreclosure judgment may be considered an interlocutory judgment that automatically becomes final upon the expiration of the redemption period, requiring no further motion or decree. What 846.30 did said, all right, you have this redemptive period, but you're going to have a judgment, a final judgment that's entered by the court, acknowledging that the redemptive period was from whatever it is, I'm going to say from the 7th of September to the 7th of October or from the 19th of October to the 18th of November, and then saying that that is the judgment of this court and adding no, there's been no other incidents to that came between the redemptive period and this judgment.
Right, Your Honor. That's the way I understand the effect and purpose of the statute.
Who was Robert Steiner working for on October 15th?
Your Honor, I think he was working for himself on the day of the accident. He was brother to the plaintiffs. He was uncle to the Vendees. What he was doing on the day of the accident, he had been doing for years before Steiner Corporation was even formed. Now that he had the brothers, the kids, in default, and the property was going downhill, he continued to preserve that property for himself and perhaps for his sister and her husband, or his brother.
Let's say that this accident occurred 3 months earlier. Why shouldn't Steiner Corporation have been responsible for someone who was really benefiting them by, I mean, he might be a volunteer, but they knew he was a volunteer. They welcomed his volunteer services. He was on the property. Come on, why shouldn't they be responsible for that?
The Steiner brothers lived on volunteer help for years while the land contract went into default. Why shouldn't they be responsible? I think it goes back to the law of master-servant respondeat superior. The question was Robert a servant to the boys, or was Robert acting in some other capacity? That's something we briefed and argued in the summary judgment motion, and my view presented then was that Robert never was hired. There was never an active engagement by the boys, the Steiner Corporation, to have him do this. This is one of the things he loved to do, and he always did. Yes, he was permitted to do it. Yes, it rendered a service. But he did it even after the boys defaulted in their land contract.
Well, the argument, as I say, would be made that he was not a 50% owner. I'm talking about Robert. He had an interest, and he was protecting, as you said, his own interest, because he knew at that time, regardless of the redemptive period, that this was coming back to him because there had been no payment made since 1998 on the property.
Precisely, Your Honor. I think he was acting for himself when he was winterizing the property.
Counsel, I want to ask you about your argument that the statute doesn't change the common law. I read the last sentence of the statute. No judgment of strict foreclosure is final until the court enters an order. What else would the legislature have had to have done if they were trying to change the common law?
I think the legislature would have to say that title, equitable title, does not revert to the vendor until a final judgment is entered. The purpose of adding the requirement of an order serves a lot of other purposes without affecting that automatic transfer.
I guess the reason I have the question is I don't see where equitable title is mentioned at all in the statute.
And, Your Honor, that's my argument. The statute doesn't mention that aspect of common law, that equitable title transfers upon failure to redeem the property. The statute just doesn't touch that issue at all, and therefore the common law rule continues unchanged.
Wemmick? Is that it?
Wemmick, Your Honor.
Who was paying for Wemmick, and who was Wemmick insuring?
WAMIC insured Steiner Corporation, the boys' corporation. And who actually paid their premium, I can't tell you. I don't know.
That coverage didn't go to the land?
No, it just covered the corporation. The acts and omissions of the employees and agents of the corporation. And so I think to connect the gap that you might be asking about, Your Honor, if the Steiner Corporation no longer had an interest in the land, it would have no basis on which to hire Robert or to employ him to be doing this work. Their connection with Robert as a corporation and his agent just expired along with their interest in the land.
Well, suppose suppose we had someone staying at the cottage, one of the cottages, after you say Steiner Corporation lost its ownership interest in the land, and they were injured. Who picks up the tab for that?
It would have been the insurance carrier for Patricia Steiner and the other vendors, who were the owners of title of the property.
But if Robert wasn't working for Patricia, what was she working for Patricia, under your theory?
I think Robert was working for himself, but he also had his own insurance. That's where Mount Morris comes in. I believe it was a homeowner's insurance policy. So Robert was covered by Mount Morris for his acts and omissions, independent of whether he was working for Steiner Brothers as well. I may have oversimplified that, but I'm trying to make it clean cut.
You just want to walk off scot-free from this, is that right?
Why not?
My question, I hope, is...
Say not Scott.
my answer, I hope, is taken in the spirit in which I intended. That is, I never walk away scot-free from the Supreme Court. I feel like a better person for it.
Oh, wow. I give you a different question. What if this action had started and instead of... So there's a... You got the judgment that's entered, not the one that's in December, but the one prior to that in October. And instead of doing anything further, the vendee gives a quick claim deed to the plaintiff. Quick claim deed is recorded. Nothing else happens. Where's the title?
I'm sorry, I missed the point. If the... Would you mind
the same, yeah, sure. We have the same facts we have here. Plaintiff sues, defendant initially resists, then they come to court, they start off with strict foreclosure, they decide not to get it, then eventually in October there is this judgment that's entered, okay? At the time the judgment is entered, the vendee of the land contract gives a quit claim to the vendor, the plaintiffs, okay? And the plaintiffs record the quit claim, never do any December 1st judgment, as we have here. Where's the title?
Title is in the vendor.
Okay, so there's no problem because the quit claim deed takes care of the record concept of title, right?
Well, that's right. Because the foreclosure action has been commenced, it's either going to be dismissed or it's going to result in a judgment. So the court is going
not
to...
Not one judgment.
We got one judgment.
Whether it's interlocutory or whether it's final, that folks mostly argue about.
I think the quitclaim deed would accomplish the same purpose.
As the final judgment under the statute.
It would be the same thing as the final judgment in the statute because it fulfills the purpose of advising the public that that the title is now clear of any claims of the vendees.
They do that, but thereafter the... vendee comes in and says, oh, I have a statutory right of redemption, and it's been cut off. And although I gave a quitclaim deed, I can't be held to cut off that statutory right of redemption. What do you think of that argument?
I would defend that, Your Honor, by arguing that the quitclaim deed does cut off whatever rights they have. That's the nature of a quitclaim deed. I don't know, when I sign the deed, I don't know what rights I may have. I can't be sure, but I'm giving them all away by signing this deed, including my right of redemption.
Although there's a statutory argument that you're protected on a right of redemption and nothing you can do. You can't waive it. You have a statutory right to it, and it's coercive for you to have waived it. I mean, it's an argument. You don't buy it.
Yes, and if we can waive sacred constitutional rights in a knowing and voluntary way, we ought to be able to waive our right to redemption. Yes.
Counsel, as I read the September 7th transcript, as the Court of Appeals read it, it was inconsistent with the October 19th judgment. That's what the Court of Appeals said. And I agree with that because... In the September 7th, although they started out with a strict foreclosure, they said, page 6 of the transcript, we'll go for the foreclosure and sale route. And then the last thing that the court said on September 7th, other than have a nice day and we're adjourned, is if there's a bid, and he talked about the sale and the bid. That was the last substantive quote. So it is clear to me, as it appears, it is clear to the Court of Appeals, that the September 7th hearing concluded with the intent to have a sheriff's sale. The Court of Appeals said that in one of the paragraphs, and it said it's inconsistent with the October 19th order, judgment. It's also clear to me that the December 1st final judgment specifically sets the period of redemption from October 19th onwards for 30 days. Your and the Court of Appeals' response is, well, it's clear, or yours and the Court of Appeals' response seems to be that was a mistake. Why isn't it just as reasonable to say October 19th judgment was a mistake when it referred to a October 7th end of period of redemption? After all, the October 19th order is inconsistent with the September 7th hearing. It is inconsistent with the terms of the December 1st. So why isn't that reasonable to say October 19th may have been a mistake?
My short answer to that question, Your Honor, is that after October 7th, the vendee no longer had any interest at all. Even if the court tried to rebreathe life into that land contract at that date, it was too late. By operation of law, the vendee's interest had already been terminated. And I think that's what makes the Court of Appeals' decision more reasonable.
Let me rephrase my question. Why isn't it just as reasonable to conclude that the parties intended that the December 1st final judgment control rather than the October 7th, you know. We don't have anything in these documents that talk about St. Joseph's and the legislative history and when does equitable title, when does the title pass. So my question focuses on, isn't it just as reasonable to conclude that the court and parties intended a 30-day period of redemption from October 19th on, as opposed to September 7th on, based on the documentation and the hearing transcript we have?
I don't think so, Your Honor. The October 19th papers reaffirm the earlier redemption date.
But the December 1 papers reaffirm.
The December 1 papers reaffirm the earlier redemption date.
They reaffirmed the October 19th.
They reaffirmed both, actually.
I don't see that. The only date, and, you know, I sometimes say it stronger than I really know, but the only date that appears in the final judgment with regard to redemption is 30 days from October 19th, 1999. There's no October 7th date. And it does make reference to I'm entering this judgment based on the attached affidavit, and the only date in the attached affidavit with regard to redemption period was the judgment provided that the defendant shall have 30 days from entering the judgment. The judgment was entered on October 19th to redeem by paying. So these final documents don't make any reference to October 7th at all.
The Court of Appeals felt that they referred to the earlier date by reference to approval of that first set of findings of fact and conclusions of law, I believe.
Do you know, counsel, is there any, do you recall, and it's fine if you don't, is there anything specific in the final judgment you can point to that would suggest that? Are you looking in your brief, counsel? I can't see what you're looking at.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Because I was saying the final judgment isn't in the appendix. I didn't know what you were looking at, but okay.
It isn't in the appendix.
It's not in the appendix.
Yes.
It doesn't appear. I got it from the record.
I'm looking in learned counsel, opposing counsel's appendix at this time.
It's not in either the appendix supplied to the court, but it is in the record.
The judgment that's in the appendix is the October one. Right. You're looking for the December one, right?
I got it, and I've read from it. Right. And I'm just saying, if you were looking in the party's appendix in the brief, it's not there. And I see nothing that refers to the earlier period of redemption, and several times it overtly states the late latter period. But maybe, if you can't find it, that's fine.
We can check. Sure. Counsel, who drafted all this, all these orders?
I can assure the court it was neither I nor Ms. Woodwell.
That's what I thought. But whose lawyer drafted them?
Well, it seems to have been drafted by Attorney Squinnick.
Squinnick from...
I know that, but who did he represent?
He represented the vendors, Mr. and Mrs. Steiner.
All right.
I agree with you, Your Honor. There is no other date in that December 1 order.
Thank you.
Justice Wilcox, do you have any other questions?
Can I ask one other question?
Justice Brasser.
In Ms. Lowell's reply brief, she talks about the relationship between Robert Steiner and Steiner Corporation. She cites the R. Sand versus City of Franklin case. She says the undisputed facts show that the parties had an understanding that Robert Steiner was to drain the cabins every fall for the benefit of the Steiner Corporation. And there are other things. Give me one last point why that doesn't create liability if the Steiner Corporation still controls this property.
Because despite what the Steiner boys say after the fact, there was never an act of engagement or employment by which Robert Steiner was asked to do this.
Who controlled the property in October?
Up until October 7, the vendee had the right to control it.
I know, but who controlled it afterwards? Because that was what Justice Frost's question
said. Also mine.
Okay, and also Justice Wilcox's.
Between October and December. October 7th.
Who actually controlled? Is it in the record?
I think inferentially it's in the record, Your Honor, because Mr. and Mrs. Steiner were living, the plaintiffs were living there. The vendors were living there.
And so you would then say the inferences they controlled. Is that the point? Did they live there prior to October?
Yes, they lived there throughout.
So we can't tell anything. Okay.
I'm going to ask the principle of law that I see is important, not necessarily, I know for you it's who wins and who loses, but as far as the equitable title passing, we could take, this court could take two approaches. It could take September 7th to October 7th, or we could take October 19th to November 18th and still preserve the transfer of equitable title occurs at the end of the redemptive period. Now, I know that you don't agree with the latter, but the former is what I'm concerned about as far as the actual transfer of title, the equitable title transferring without a judgment.
The difficulty I see with doing the second, thinking that the second date, Your Honor, the later date would have some viability is that we know that the vendees did not meet that first date and had no intention of doing so. That was explored in the colloquy between Judge Palifka and the parties in that September 17 meeting. So it would have been a windfall, a gift. There would have been no equitable reason to let the vendees stay in possession after the 7th. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. Thank you. I have a few things that I'd like to say. First off, this issue between whether you're reaffirming something that has already been done by submitting the order or whether it's a confirmation or a declaration of the transfer of title. I think that the cases use the terms final and absolute. Both St. Joseph's Hospital and the Exchange Corp, the Coons case, uses these terms to mean it's a transfer of interest. It's a changing of the guard. It's a changing of interest. They do not use them in terms of it's confirming, it's quieting the title, although there is mention of quieting the title in St. Joseph's, but it's used in addition to declaring the right and barring the defendant's interest.
But the right, I'm concerned about the actual passing of the equitable title. In other words, when does the vendee lose it? And under the Exchange Corporation, if I read it correctly, that it automatically becomes final upon the expiration of the redemptive period, requiring no further motion or decree to make it absolute, to make it final.
I read Exchange Corp a little bit differently. I think that the court, in discussing that possibility, they're saying it may be interpreted this way. They look at several different ways that it can be interpreted. They looked at the Monona Golf Course case. They looked at some comments by other justices. And they ultimately turned to the language in the judgment, whether the court reserved the power to extend the redemption period after the redemption period had expired. And that's kind of the key here, because how can a court have, in equity, still have a right to go in there and change things up once the redemption period has automatically?
Aren't we debating here when the period of redemption ended? I pose this to opposing counsel, whether we pick the first 30 days or the second 30 days. The point is that the case, the Exchange case, indicated that this court, our court, has no inherent power, or the court has no inherent power to extend the period once the redemptive period has expired. That's what the case stands for. So whether it's the first one, you're arguing that neither apply, that you have to have a judgment by the court, and then the period goes on at least 7 days from that point.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
So under your argument, when did that start?
The judgment did not happen until October 19th when it was signed by the judge. There was, according to the statute, there should be a 7-day redemption period. And if there's a redemption period expires, the transfer of interest of in the property does not occur until a final order is entered in to confirm, or reaffirm, I should say, that no redemption was made.
So the first hearing was, what, meaningless, or it just didn't count? That's a September hearing.
The reason why it doesn't count in this instance is that the redemption period applied to a share of sale. And when you have a share of sale, the redemption period, it pertains to time to redeem. It doesn't transfer the title as it does in strict foreclosure.
Even though the plaintiffs were applying for strict foreclosure in their papers on the 7th of September.
Yes, they changed their mind. They sought a different relief. It's on the record.
Counsel, the St. Joseph's case. What was the holding of the St. Joseph's case, as you understand it?
Well, that is a very complicated case. I've read it so many times. But
let me ask this in an easier way then. Is it to have a final hearing to, quote, declare in quiet title? A final order, rather, to declare in quiet title?
St. Joseph's case, from my perspective, is getting at what the power of the court is when you have this type of judgment. And it was during the Depression, and there were a lot of emergency statutes that were enacted. And the way that they were able to legitimize these statutes and apply them to judgments that were entered before the enactment of those statutes was because they found that the court still had inherent power to change the rights, the redemption period, change the rights.
St. Joseph's dealt with the ability to extend the period of redemption, the court's ability to do that. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And in the St. Joseph's case, the court provided for in order to make the matter complete, you needed a final order to, quote, to declare in quiet title. Is that correct?
And to make it absolute, that's correct. In addressing something that you had said, Justice Wilcox, the Exchange Court does reserve a situation where the court in equity can extend a redemption period after the redemption period expired, and that's if it's reserved in the judgment itself. So you still have a situation where if someone hasn't paid within the redemption period,
they can come back and request the court to give them additional time. And that presents one of the issues that I believe this legislature was trying to address. And I'm out of time.
Should the Steiner Corporation be responsible for Robert Steiner?
The Steiner?
They never paid him a dime, did they?
Pardon me?
They never paid him a dime.
The law related to respondeat superior and vicarious liability does not concentrate on whether or not there is payment. It can be voluntary. And the key is whether or not there's a right to control and whether the or not the parties consented, both the person who's acting as a servant as well as the principal who has the right to control, to have the servant principal relationship to allow vicarious liability. And the civil jury instructions as well as the Arsand case talks about it doesn't matter about intentions of the parties, that the parties' relationship can be shown through the conduct. The intentions don't matter. It's the right to control of the principal and the fact that the servant was acting to the benefit of the Steiner Corporation. And those things are here in the record.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Ms. Luell, and thank you, Mr. Yamachek, for your arguments today relating both to agency matters and land contracts. It's been a while since we had a land contract suit. That concludes the hearing on 03-1959 Steiner v. Wisconsin Mutual Insurance Company et al. And the court is in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45. The court will meet in the conference room at 3:15. We are in recess.